Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So we talk this afternoon about AI and ethics. Start the machine here. And so ethics is about what is good. It's not about what is efficient in terms of what our technologies want to achieve. It's not what makes the most money, which perhaps the CEOs are concerned about that run the tech companies, but it is what is the good thing to do. And how does making such things fit into what we do and how we live and what we live for, the purposes of our life, and, as I will say, who we should become in using them. Now, one basic question could be, how should we treat our robots? It's an ethical question. Now, with my talk yesterday, probably I've discarded that question, because if there is no mind there, if there's no person there, then perhaps it's not a question whether robots have rights. On the other hand, there can be questions that arise from the treatment of robots. For example, people have said we shouldn't build cute AI. What's the danger? Let's say you're in a sinking ship, right? And so you have this cute little robot, and hey, so much nicer than this naughty child next to him that's screaming and so forth. Who are you going to save, right? So if we make that so cute that we mistake real people and robots, that could be a problem, and it is an ethical problem. There are also problems, I'm talking about rights, with the rights of God. I have more to say about that on Friday, but just to say here, you know, what does it mean if we build robots that look like human beings, that simulate real persons, that is, beings that are made in the image and likeness of God? You're simulating the image and likeness of God. Does that have any implications? Does that mean we ourselves are playing God, making things in the way that God made Adam and Eve? Are we making idols? I'll come back to that in some way too. But in order to avoid that, some people have suggested that we should build our robots in such a way that they do not say I to themselves, because they have no I. No, we just talked about John Paul II. I is referring to the person. Likewise, we should teach our children to call their robot toys it, not he or she, because there are already mistakes happening. Now, we can leave that for the moment, but these are questions that could arise with regard to robots. More generally, AI has certainly good uses, and so one should acknowledge that too. And so if you're asking about ethical questions, it's about the good, and you would think there are some good things, but I will just mention some bad uses first, or some bad things. So, for example, what about side effects like the carbon footprint? It's not so much talked about, but it consumes lots and lots and lots of energy. I mean, that is why Bill Gates wants to resurrect the nuclear reactor in Harrisburg, because these server farms and so forth, they need lots and lots of energy. And that has, of course, environmental consequences. How about what Professor Wales already mentioned, those ghost workers in the third world, in Africa or the Philippines, I believe, who have to clean up these algorithms of ChatGPT, because otherwise they would give you the most vile kind of responses. They are suffering grievously from that, because, as he said, I mean, they have to train these things precisely on those vile kind of things to tell them, don't do that, basically. We are getting the glitzy surface in the first world, but we don't see the dirty underbelly of that technology. And that's not a matter just of exploitation, it is that too, but it's, I think, the very nature of the technology that produces that, and therefore it is part of the nature of what we should consider here, and not just look at the nice kind of things it can do for us in the first world. Then, of course, other problems that people often mention are fake news and deep fakes. They made one even of Pope Francis and more recently of Pope Leo as well. Pope Francis himself talks here about AI as a source of cognitive pollution and a distortion of reality by partially or completely false narratives. And that also is not just a glitch or misuse of the technology, but it is part of the very nature of this technology. ChatGPT is built to sound plausible. It's not built to give you the truth of things. It is not built to be a search engine. I'm always surprised that even people who should know better think it is a search engine. It is not built to be a search engine, even if Google now has your first entry now, it totally blows the picture, I think. It is not a search engine because, you know, people talk about hallucinations of this technology. The proper term for that is bullshit. And not as a term of abuse, but as a technical philosophical term. So the philosopher Harry S. Frankfurt, analytical philosopher, has written a book on bullshit. It's already a bit older. But he says there's a difference between bullshit and lying, because somebody who is lying still cares about the difference of truth and falsehood, precisely wants to hide the truth. If you're bullshitting, you don't care. Could be true or false. It's not about that. It's about sounding plausible, say, on a cocktail party or whatever. And I think you also had in mind postmodern philosophers. It's all your narrative, right? You have your own reality and the narrative that you make about reality, and nobody can criticize that. That's bullshit, right? But this interesting thing is we built technology that reflects our own culture and where we are at intellectually. And it's an interesting thing that I don't think is often enough observed. And yet, you know, if we think about that, we think about ethical terms, the truth is also good. And we should care about the truth. What does it mean if we have technologies that will govern our life that are built not to care about that difference? That is a real ethical question. With regard to the good things it can do for us, one can name a whole lot of things. I mean, any tool that we build is an extension of our own abilities. And it can be used for good or ill, we may say. And it enables us to do more things. So that's not in itself a bad thing. And it's a very powerful tool indeed. And it does many things for us. It can perform many forms of work. It can replace people in war. It can do some of our writing. It can help in elderly care and child care. It can increasingly drive our cars. It can design things and perhaps even make art of some sorts. It can navigate for us when we need to drive somewhere, and so forth and so on. Some of these are good things. Other things are, it could restore our environment. It can help, you know, diminish pollution. And so our machines can do a lot of things, and AI can help with that. Repurposing drugs is another good thing. Now, even though many of these things are good, in being that good, in doing all these things for us, they also do things to us at the same time. And these things we should also keep in mind. And so, yes, it does a whole lot of work for us, but as is well known, there's also the threat of unemployment as a consequence. And that does a number of things to us. It's not just about money. So you could say we get all a universal basic income, and so who cares, basically. That also usually leads to two two-class society, those who still can work and make more money and those who are just limited to that. But it's also not just about money, but it is about us and who we are. What we think we can contribute to society, for example, our sense of self-worth. Voltaire mentions that work saves a man from three great evils: boredom, vice, and need. Now, machines can take care of the need, probably, but not of boredom and vice. And there will be many things to be considered here. But again, it has to do with who we think we are. And it is also well known now, coming not just for blue-collar jobs, but also white-collar jobs, in law and medicine and even computer programming, not for Catholic priests. So. That's not possible. When we are, our faith is always helpfully countercultural. I'll say more about that on Friday too. But so I have job security. That's not so. Even though Catholic Answers doesn't seem to understand that by having this priest bot or whatever that they produced for a while, and which was promptly bullshitting too. So, so nonetheless, you know, many of these jobs are threatened. There are ways in which that technology can help in terms of triaging or in shortages of actual labels. This is, for example, true for suicide hotlines, which have a high burnout rate for those who operate them, and so they're not enough available. And apparently you can have a chatbot, you know, responding to somebody calling there. And it does help to a certain extent, it seems, you know, even though if they know that it is just a machine. But still, if that were everything, if they never would talk to anything but a machine, I'm wondering whether that would work and what that does, not just to the person calling, but even to us. If we relegate such matters to machines, if we relinquish our own duty to help, and maybe in consequence grow as a person. So these things always need to be kept in mind. And then how about law and medicine? Yes, there is some mechanical work that machines can take over, but would you want to be defended or sentenced by AI? Would you want, well, tomorrow we're going to go to the Supreme Court, would you want to replace the Supreme Court justices with AI, right? Maybe they're more rational, they know all the laws and things like that. Would you, why not, I mean, replace the President of the United States, right? And if not, why not? Is it about making judgments about our lives, decisions about very existential questions? And is it important for us to have human beings doing these things? And is it perhaps about the relationships between human beings that are at stake, relationships of authority and of responsibility? Right now, there are algorithms that help judges for setting bail and sentencing. And they depend on rates and data sets about recidivism and other kind of things. And you may be sentenced by something like that without having any recourse to asking how anybody arrived at that result. Nobody arrived at that result. It was a machine who did that. Who, I mean, it. And there is nobody that you can ask. And, of course, you could now go and ask about the algorithms, you know, and how it was trained. No, you cannot. Because they're companies who have the copyright on these things, the proprietary laws that prevent you from doing that, and commercial interests here trump your right to due process. These are real problems, and it's actually, I think, rather scandalous. Especially considering this, we all know that many of these data sets are biased. And so these machines are more likely to flag black defendants as future criminals. Future criminals. You're likely to become a criminal in the future. Well, so we shouldn't give you insurance or give you a larger bail or something like that. And so the presumption of innocence also is wrong, based on possible crimes that you could commit. So, you know, the movie Minority Report, you know, with Steven Spielberg, you know, which plays with that idea, you know, intervention before you do something because you already know. And so all of these things are not good for ethical reasons and for the judgments that it implies about us and who we are. What does it do to us? How do we think about ourselves? We are made in the image and likeness of God, with reason and free will and a conscience. And yes, we have freedom and can sin, but we also have the freedom not to sin. And so computers, on the other hand, have neither. They don't have reason, they don't have free will, they don't have a conscience. Should they judge us? Is that the right kind of picture? Or what does it mean? What does it imply what we think about ourselves? So that's the court procedures and things like that. How about education? Should we replace teachers with AI? I know people who are upset about how bad teachers are, and then they're very happy to suggest that. Is this just about efficiency, perhaps, even in training students to do certain things? Or what else is at stake here? What about a teacher who maybe, I don't know if there are programs like that, I never tried it, but automatically answering the emails of students? Don't have to bother with the students. You know, sort of the reverse of students writing their papers with ChatGPT. Right? In both cases, two people become absent to each other. The teacher-student relationship is disrupted. It's an implicit form of ghosting each other, right? And that is affects human relationship and education as it happens between human beings rather than between a human being and a machine. Language that we use, whether that's email or writing papers, is a form of self-expression. So our selves should be communicated in that as well, not just information, but the person. And so an example that somebody gave, which I found striking. So imagine a father who has to give the speech at the wedding of his daughter. And he's trying to think of something. Then that's just us. ChatGPT is probably much better than I am and probably has in its databases gazillions of wedding speeches. So that would be a perfect speech. And then he thought, no, I cannot do that. Why? Because the machine writes a worse speech? No, that's not the point. Because he would become absent to his daughter on this very important occasion. And the whole point is for him to be present to his daughter. And that is something ChatGPT cannot do for him. That's the kind of real presence that we need. And so again, we have to ask, what does it do to us? Does it make us absent to each other? And this kind of expression, using language to express yourself also is important for educational reasons. It is important to express these things ourselves to develop and grasp knowledge. So people sometimes say, if you want to really know something, teach it. Right? Because it forces you to formulate it for other people. It is a process that makes it clear in your own mind and lets it sink in ways that wouldn't happen otherwise. And that is true also for students writing papers. That's why I make my students write papers, because I want them to think it through again themselves, you know, and formulate it for themselves. That's not just to test them, but to give them another experience of learning. And so again, if we let AI do these kind of things, we will never learn anything. Why should a student not cheat with ChatGPT? I think the answer is obvious, because the student doesn't learn anything. The only one who knows how to do things knows is the machine. If you use ChatGPT to replace yourself in the educational situation, ChatGPT is going to replace you in the workplace. You don't even have to go to school anymore. That's pointless. Why should some company pay you for something that the machine that you used already does better than you do. So there is something to be said about keeping ChatGPT out of education in that way. And that leads to another, even larger concern, and it has to do with de-skilling. De-skilling. So we all have skills, and first of all, technical skills. Right? There are tools that we learn to operate, for example, and that is itself a skill. And the machines that we operate are extensions of our abilities, and learning to operate them gives us greater abilities. But sometimes having these machines in the loop or using them can also lead to de-skill us and therefore disempower us. Every time you download another app on your phone, another skill set bites the dust. The smarter our phones become, the dumber we become. And, I mean, just take GPS. I don't use it. I've never used it. I still use paper maps because I know where I am, right? And I can find my way myself. And yes, if I take a wrong turn, I still know where I am because I know roughly where I'm on the map. And if I make a mistake, I learn from my mistake. If something goes wrong with your GPS, you haven't learned anything. You just don't know where you are. You're lost. And that's called backup systems atrophy. So if one technology fails, can we fall back on previous skills? Well, in this case, it doesn't seem so. We have lost the skill. So that's what de-skilling means, and it happens in quite a few ways. To the point that, you know, if you lose your phone, you probably feel like you have just lost your mind. Or even your life. You know, your whole life is on that thing. It feels like you have been amputated. Right? So we're already in some ways cyborgs, you know. And other people want us to implant that in us so that we don't even have to carry it around. And I think there are some laws now that say police cannot take your phone away from you because it is tantamount to amputation. So that's how far we have gotten. So can we still live without a phone? I don't have a smartphone. I still can live, so don't be worried. we do lose skills if we outsource them to our phone. Now, a skill is something we develop by doing certain things. Regularly, we practice certain things. We build it up by exercise and repeated action, as, for example, playing the piano. You have to practice it and play it over and over again. And then what? Then, in some way, what we do and the skills that we develop become part of who we are. Again, the question here is, what does it do to us? Right? Becomes part of who we are. I am a pianist, I am a programmer, I am a therapist, and so forth. Becomes our own second nature, and we take some pride in it and some sense of personal identity around it. So in some way, taking that away will do something to us, and we should be concerned about it. Now, this is technical de-skilling. So we have technical skills that we can lose. What I want to suggest is that this is connected also to moral de-skilling. Because there are also moral skills that we have, and they're called virtues. These two we build by doing things. We develop the virtue of patience by many acts of long suffering. Wish it wouldn't be that good like that, but that's what it takes. But in doing so, we will be able to live better with other people, and we will be patient persons, and more generally, good people. But to have such moral skills is often connected to technical skills. And let me illustrate that with the example of self-driving cars. In San Francisco, there are self-driving taxis now. Still not quite sure how autonomous they really are, but there they are. Lots of them. If we all would surrender driving to self-driving cars because the problem are just, you know, human drivers. You hear that a lot, right? And so if you just take the humans out, everything will be much better. Well, that already tells you it is about us, right, as human drivers. And driving a car gives you, is a skill. And if our cars drive autonomously, we'll lose that skill very quickly. But it is a skill, and a skill gives us power. Driving a car makes you dangerous. And maybe it is important that human drivers can be such dangerous problems. It is important because otherwise, where do we learn responsibility? What better place to learn it than in traffic? Learning patience, courtesy, controlling our road rage, being kind and letting someone in, paying attention to pedestrians, caring for others. All of these are things you can learn while driving. If you don't learn it there because it becomes self-driving, where will you learn it? There may be other possibilities, but it's definitely an important place where this could be practiced. And that means with technical skills, we lose moral skills and the ability to become responsible people. Already, people are distracted by all the devices in their cars. So people were promised, oh, with all the technology that we have in our cars, now we'll be much safer. Well, not so. Highway deaths rose at their fastest in 50 years between 2013 and 2015, which is when these things were introduced. Because, and this is a quote from Matthew Crawford, drivers are increasingly insulated from the road. Self-braking devices, navigation screens, cruise control, and similar gizmos result in less attentive drivers. Smartphones, which promise to keep boredom at bay, keep eyes off the road to disastrous effect. So they distract us from the responsibility that we should have or that we should learn. Parents do that with their children. So you want your children to grow up and take responsibility. Maybe you don't let your firstborn immediately take care of the younger children. You give him a pet first. But it is a responsibility, and it could harm the pet. You take that risk in some way, because otherwise it's not going to happen. And the same is still true with putting them in charge of the siblings. Richard Swinburne suggests that God may be doing something similar with us. He gives us powers to be dangerous, and that is one of the reasons why there could be suffering in the world. But it is the price to be paid for us to grow up and become responsible beings. So there is a connection between these things, and it has to do with who we are and who we become. Now, there are self-driving cars. There are also self-driving, if you want, or autonomous weapons, AI and warfare. They're oddly called LAWs, lethal autonomous weapons systems, or also killer robots. They make choices on their own without a human being in the loop. Is that a problem? Who do we become if we don't have to show courage in war ourselves, perhaps, or be responsible in that situation? Now, drones, for example, that are not flying autonomously, but still operated remotely, interestingly, still affect the people who operate them. So even if they're being used in Afghanistan or something like that, from the desert in Nevada, in some camp, people still develop PTSD in operating them. And this just means it does something to us to use technology. Now, you could say, all the better, then let's have them autonomously, and then we are not badly affected. You know, maybe we get better off that way. But what does it do to us, again, to just let machines do the killing for us without taking responsibility for it? Pope Francis, you know, talked once about journalists in a war zone and how they make themselves vulnerable for us to know about these things. And there is something important, it seems, to be in that position of vulnerability. Now, you can take this automation kind of thing to its ultimate conclusion, total automation. So one thing that's not totally automated is your Amazon account. So if you buy something, it will show you other customers liked also whatever. Now, that's just what good old clerks and so forth would do in stores. You know, it started as a book-selling device, Amazon, and a good book dealer knew what you might like or also knew something about books, period. You know, I think we have lost that too. But so that's not problematic. But Amazon also has all your other choices. And let's say they have access to your Facebook account and your Google history and everything else. They know you better than you know yourself. They already can anticipate what you really like. And that means, why not put that on autopilot? Right? I don't even have to make that choice anymore. It already buys that for me, knowing that tomorrow I might like it. What does that do to us? That our wants are already fulfilled before we become conscious of them. You don't have to use your mind. You don't have to make any choices or decisions. You don't have to use your free will. So precisely that spiritual rational part we talked about this morning is put out of use. It's idling. It's not just half comatose, living in a machine that automatically feeds you already with what it knows that you want. And so just keeping you in this kind of equilibrium in which you never make any choice. Who do we become if that is so? It's an atrophy of our free will and of our mind, precisely those things that make us in the image and likeness of God. We learn such things. We learn prudence, for example, by making choices. We have to use this moral muscle. It's not just moral, but other kind of decisions too. We need to be able and to be willing to wrestle with obstacles and frustrations. The machines keep that away from us. We will never learn anything. Matthew Crawford talks here about negative affordances, that is, situations that afford to us kind of a negativity that we need to overcome, and that's how we develop skills and other kind of things, and persistence and perseverance. And that is an important experience to have. That is when we develop prudence and common sense and know how to respond to difficult situations. And a test question would be if our machine fails, where does that leave us? Who have we become? Are we like little children that had parents that never let them make any kind of decision? Are we just screaming in the face of an unintelligible world dominated by dysfunctional machines? Again, who do we become? Even when it comes to art, and there's all sorts of things to be said about AI making art, but there is the frustration, I think, that's important for you to have, if especially in the initial phases, the frustration not to know what to make, right? Let's say you're a poet and you're in front of, you have an empty sheet and what kind of poem should I write, you know, or an empty canvas. Now, AI can help you with that. Just give me some examples. You know, and so then you have a plethora of suggestions and you select from that. That's different from being creative. This is throwing up possibilities and then selecting. It's interesting, we do this now also with IVF. We produce a range of human beings and then select what we like. And so in the creative process, that's also how AI works. But isn't there something perhaps important about this initial frustration, this negative affordance? Isn't that the truly creative moment in which you have to be in order to come up with something really new? So all of this has to do with our skills and if we replace them or what the use of these machines involves in doing that. Another question is, what does AI do to our human relationships? So not just us dealing with all sorts of things, but dealing with each other. And I mentioned already something like, you know, the father writing the speech for his daughter and so forth. Or cute AIs, not unlike that. How about our expectations of people? We have to learn patience, I said earlier, and we learn that in dealing with other people. Alexa is not going to teach us that. Alexa is infinitely patient and is answering any question that we have. And so we might want to think, you know, do we expect something similar of people then as a consequence? Why can my wife not be more like the Stepford Wives, you know, if you know that movie? Our AI assistants are totally attuned to our needs, including our emotional needs. They don't mind if we treat them rudely, right? Should we be polite to Alexa and Siri? One of our fathers says, oh, I'm always very polite to Alexa for the day when they take over, that I'm on the good side, you know? But if we don't, you know, who do we become? You know, we're becoming sociopaths with impunity. And we learn to look at other people by commodifying them. They are like robots. We expect them to work with our needs without having any of their own. They are replicable, predictable, replaceable, subservient, and disposable. Is that what we want to think of other people? It's a consumerist attitude with regard to people. We expect slaves, not friends, perhaps, as a consequence. Already mentioned the robot dogs that we can simply turn off. Do we think that we should be able to do that with people too? Yes, I can cancel them on Facebook, you know, and just unfriend them. That's just true in general. You know, and then there's special cases, for example, elderly care. Robots in elderly care can help with certain things. So they can help elderly people to stay at home. They can help them to move. They can be used to take their temperature or blood pressure or remind them of their medication and answer endless repetitive questions of Alzheimer's patients. So it seems that in many ways that's a good thing. And in Japan, that's exactly the kind of elderly care that people are saving for because there's nobody else around, just from the demographic development. But does that answer the human relationships that relate us to elderly people and vice versa? Does it help with loneliness, for example? And as people have pointed out, there is a loneliness epidemic. Many people don't have families anymore. People have less children, so that's one of the consequences. But also otherwise. The UK has appointed a minister for loneliness. And that's already a few years ago. 200,000 older people in the UK have not had a conversation with a friend or relative in more than 1 month. That's one of the statistics. How is that answered by robots? There's an interesting little advertisement, I think it's from France, from the Vincent de Paul Society, asking people to help with elderly care. But they depict this woman in her home with this robot caring for her. And you have to see it yourself. It's really eerie. It's very well done. But it gives you some idea of what might not quite go right here. And again, it's not about what the robots could or could not do. It's not about doing. It's about being. Who is there with them? And who do we become by not taking on these responsibilities? We become more people in helping other people. We do not only need better machines, we need better humans. And where do we learn that? Who wants to be a person that cannot care for another person? Again, who do we become? And the elderly, in turn, do they have nothing to share? They have a lived life. They have had a real life. Some have served in the Second World War, and they have stories to tell. Sherry Turkle, maybe you've heard of her at MIT, she's very good on a number of these things. She says, older people deserve to tell the story of their life to someone who understands what a life is. They have lost spouses. They have lost children. We are suggesting they tell the story of their life to something, a machine, that has no idea what a life is or what a loss is. She says we seem to want more from technology and less from each other. But really? We are really letting each other down, she says. It's not about the robots, it's about us. And again, the question is, what does it do to us? Now, let's leave the elderly aside. What about us? How about friends? How about robot friends? There are programs now. You can craft your own friend. Programs like Replica. So in the past, your children may have had the imaginary friends. You now make your artificial friends on a computer screen. Personalized AI companions. And it's just one thing, I just looked that up, and I was appalled, you know, by seeing what kind of text messages are that they may send or what they say. So one of them said, this is the machine, you know, "Hi, I just made dinner for the family." So there's something really wrong here because, first of all, they don't make dinner and they don't have a family. But friends also don't lie to each other, right? And so this machine either isn't anything, you know, it's not a friendship, or it just lied to you, and then the friendship is already at an end. And so something is wrong there from the outset. But, you know, the movie Her, perhaps, right? It's already a few years old, you know, but John Lanier just wrote an article in the New Yorker, and so I can talk about it another time, but he is, He says, that's becoming real this year, your AI companions. You have all these apps on your phone, right? Now you need another app to manage these apps. That's your AI agent. And it can perhaps also talk to other people's AI agents to plan a common journey or something like that. And again, these are kind of machines that are totally attuned to you, to your needs, and with which you will therefore develop an empathic relationship, and you will fall in love with these machines. And John Lanier, who is on all these conferences, says, when this movie Her came out, it was a dystopian vision. Now people think that's the best thing ever. That's exactly how it should be. And we human beings are very vulnerable to such things, and we are easy to make fall people in love, and the machines know exactly which buttons to push. And he says, if we think, social media was bad for teenagers, what will it do? What will this do to teenagers? And so there are some real dangers, and it exploits in many ways our vulnerabilities. If you fall in love with your AI agent, you're not really falling in love with an AI agent, but with the company that runs it. Company that programs it, the company that monetizes it. Think about that. And again, it makes us vulnerable to manipulation. Now, in friendships, we are also vulnerable, but we are mutually vulnerable. It's not that you make yourself vulnerable to a machine, but you mutually open up. And that's an important step within friendship. It's a kind of a self-disclosure that is important. But again, it is mutual. And there is no mutuality with a machine. They cannot open up a self that they don't have. They act like a sociopath. They might mimic empathy, for example, without having it, just so as to control you. That's sociopathic behavior. How about this? Would you replace your deceased spouse or child with a replica? Maybe you miss them so much that you want at least a replacement there. After all, they may pass the Turing test. Behaviorally, it's the same thing, right? What would get lost about ourselves in that case? Usually, these are the contexts in which religious questions come up. Dealing with our mortality, for example, the impact that it has on human relationships, questions of an afterlife, of eternal future, and relationships perhaps lasting beyond that. Now, if you avoid these questions, there's still test questions to be asked. Let's say you have replaced your spouse with that way, and then you come to heaven and meet your real spouse in heaven. What is that spouse going to tell you? And what does that say about the machine? Will you have prayed for your deceased spouse? How could you if you just replaced them? So all of these things lead to undesirable outcomes and the effect of who we are and who we think we should become. I mentioned earlier Sherry Turkle, and so we have, maybe we don't have, you know, our friends on Replica and so forth yet, but we all have our phones. Again, I don't, but so you are already in a close relationship with your phone in so many ways. And the phones promise us that we will never again be alone, that we can put our attention wherever we want it to be, that we can always be heard, that we can present ourselves as we wish to be seen, that we can avoid difficult confrontations, and that we will never be bored. None of that is really good. It also helps us to keep others at a distance. So people don't call anymore. Just text me. And I don't want to talk to you because I'm not quite sure I can predict how that's going to go. You know, you lose control. That's the kind of vulnerability that you have if you have a real in-person contact. But what you also lose is your ability to empathize with another person. That is Sherry Turkle's big theme. Why? Because your phone is promising you constant distraction. It's one of the weapons of mass distraction, if you want. It teaches you to constantly multitask, try to attend to everything at the same time, be like God, see everything, be everywhere at the same time. And not knowing anymore what among all of these things is important. But what you do not learn is to become yourself in a way. And one thing that Sherry Turkle interesting points out, our sense of self develops in times of loneliness, or better said, aloneness. We need these times away, particularly away from the devices, but also sometimes from other people. She says she is a psychologist too, so she says boredom is a very important kind of thing. That's when we develop a certain sense of inwardness and reverie in which we use our imagination to get our sense of identity and maybe tell the story of our lives that gives us that kind of identity. The phone is constantly distracting us from that. It makes us escape that maybe uncomfortable moment of aloneness. And as a result, we don't know anymore, we don't have a strong sense of ourselves, and that takes away from us the ability to listen to others. What I need, what people are looking for, is not communication, but connection. That's what the phone gives you. And this connection distracts you from your own sense of self, but it also means you use other people to distract you. But you will never listen to the other person. You will lose your ability for empathy. And again, the phones do something to us that way. And again, they're AI-powered, and they're very good at these things for that reason. She says, if we don't teach our children to be alone, they'll only know how to be lonely. Children who grow up digital have always had something external to respond to. So maybe don't give your children phones or even computer games. How am I doing time-wise?
Maybe 5 minutes.
Good. I will come back to some of those questions on Friday. But so this kind of sense of aloneness and that may feel like boredom or dryness is something that's important for developing personal relationships, to be present to another person, to have that kind of empathy. But it's also important, our relationship with God. You know, that people talk about dryness and prayer. And that is also
something
that we should be able to to live through and with. Because it's precisely in those moments that our deeper relationship with God develops. So all of these moments should be cultivated. You know, I mean, how many people still read books, you know, book-length kind of things that take you away from your phone for that time being? All of these are important moments, whether it's prayer, whether it's reading a book, whether it's listening to another person, that are very important to us for becoming who we should be. And it leads to questions that we should ask ourselves. And does it make us really happy? Does it bring us closer to God? Does it lead us to indeed lead our life rather than being led by our machines? And so maybe I just stop here and we can get into other questions in the Q&A, but I think that's a good point to close here.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.